It was early in April in the year 83 that I woke one morning to find Sherlock Holmes standing fully dressed by the side of my bed. He was a late riser, as a rule, and as the clock on the mantelpiece showed me that it was only 7:15, I blinked up at him in some surprise. What is it, a fire? No, a client. It seems that a young lady has arrived in a considerable state of excitement who insists upon seeing me. I rapidly threw on my clothes and was ready in a few minutes to accompany my friend down to the sitting room. A lady dressed in black and heavily veiled, who had been sitting in the window, rose as we entered. "Good morning, madam," said Holmes cheerily. "My name is Sherlock Holmes. This is my intimate friend and associate, Dr. Watson, before whom you may speak as freely as before myself. Ah, I am glad to see that Mrs. Hudson has had the good sense to light the fire. Pray draw up to it, and I shall order you a cup of hot coffee, for I observe that you are shivering." "It is not cold which makes me shiver," said the woman. "What then?" "It is fear, Mr. Holmes. It is terror." She raised her veil as she spoke, and we could see that she was indeed in a pitiable state of agitation. Her features and figure were those of a woman of 30, but her hair was shot with premature grey, and her expression was weary and haggard. "You must not fear," said he, bending forward and patting her forearm. "We shall soon set matters right, I have no doubt. You have come in by train this morning, I see. You know me, then?" "No, but I observed the second half of a return ticket inside the palm of your left glove." "You must have started early, and yet you had a good drive in a dog cart along heavy roads before you reached the station." The lady stared in bewilderment at my companion. "There is no mystery, my dear madam," said he, smiling. "The left arm of your jacket is spattered with mud in no less than 7 places. The marks are perfectly fresh. There is no vehicle save a dog cart which throws up mud in that way, and then only when you sit on the left-hand side of the driver." "Whatever your reasons may be, you are perfectly correct," said she. "Oh, sir, do you not think that you could help me?"
"I am all attention, madam."
"My name is Helen Stoner, and I live with my stepfather, who is the last survivor of one of the oldest Saxon families in England, the Roylotts of Stoke Moran, on the western border of Surrey."
Holmes nodded his head. "The name is familiar to me," said he.
"When Dr. Roylott was in India, he married my mother, Mrs. Stoner, the young widow of Major General Stoner of the Bengal Artillery. My sister Julia and I were twins, and we were only 2 years old at the time of my mother's remarriage. She had a considerable sum of money, not less than £1,000 a year, and this she bequeathed to Dr. Roylott entirely while we resided with him, with a provision that a certain annual sum should be allowed to each of us in the event of our marriage. Shortly after our return to England, my mother died. She was killed 8 years ago in a railway accident near Crewe. Dr. Roylott then abandoned his attempts to establish himself in practice in London and took us to live with him in the old ancestral house at Stoke Moran. The money which my mother had left was enough for all our wants, and there seemed to be no obstacle to our happiness. But a terrible change came over my stepfather about this time. Instead of making friends and exchanging visits with our neighbours, who had at first been overjoyed to see a Roylott of Stoke Moran back in the old family seat, he shut himself up in his house and seldom came out, save to indulge in ferocious quarrels with whomever might cross his path. He had no friends at all, save the wandering gypsies, and he would give these vagabonds leave to encamp upon the few acres of bramble-covered land which represent the family estate. He has a passion also for Indian animals, which are sent over to him by a correspondent, and he has at this very moment a cheetah and a baboon which wander freely over his grounds and are feared by the villagers almost as much as their master. You can imagine from what I say that my poor sister Julia and I had no great pleasure in our lives. She was but 30 at the time of her death, and her hair had already begun to whiten, even as mine has.
Your sister is dead, then?
Yes, it is of her death that I wish to speak to you in part. At Christmas 2 years ago, my sister met a half-pay major of Marines to whom she became engaged. My stepfather learned of it and offered no objection to the marriage, but within a fortnight of the day which had been fixed for the wedding, the terrible event occurred which has deprived me of my only companion.
Sherlock Holmes had been leaning back in his chair with his eyes closed and his head sunk in a cushion. But he half opened his lids now and glanced across at his visitor. "Pray be precise as to details," said he.
"The manor house is very old, and only one wing is now inhabited.
The first bedroom is Dr. Roylott's, the second my sister's, and the third my own. On the fatal night, Dr. Roylott had gone to his room early, though we knew that he had not retired to rest, for my sister was troubled by the smell of the strong Indian cigars which it was his custom to smoke. She left her room, therefore, and came into mine, where she sat for some time chatting about her approaching wedding. At 11 o'clock she rose to leave me, but she paused at the door and looked back. Tell me, Helen, said she, have you ever heard anyone whistle in the dead of the night? Never, said I. I suppose that you could not possibly whistle yourself in your sleep. Oh, certainly not, but why? Because during the last few nights I have always, about 3 o'clock in the morning, heard a low, clear whistle. I'm a light sleeper, and it has awakened me. I cannot tell where it came from, perhaps from the next room, perhaps from the lawn. I thought that I would just ask you whether you had heard it. No, I have not. It must be those wretched gypsies in the plantation. Very likely. Well, it is of no great consequence at any rate. She smiled back at me, closed my door, and a few moments later I heard her key turn in the lock. Indeed, said Holmes. Was it your custom always to lock yourself in at night? Always. And why? I think that I mentioned to you that the doctor kept a cheetah and a baboon. Quite so. Pray proceed with your statement. I could not sleep that night. A vague feeling of impending misfortune impressed me. It was a wild night. The wind was howling outside and the rain was beating and splashing against the windows. Suddenly, amid all the hubbub of the gale, there burst forth the wild scream of a terrified woman. I knew that it was my sister's voice. I sprang from my bed, wrapped a shawl round me, and rushed into the corridor. As I ran down the passage, my sister's door was unlocked and revolved slowly upon its hinges. I stared at it, horror-stricken, not knowing what was about to issue from it. By the light of the corridor lamp, I saw my sister appear at the opening. I ran to her and threw my arms about her. But at that moment her knees seemed to give way, and she fell to the ground. She writhed as one who is in terrible pain, and her limbs were dreadfully convulsed. As I bent over her, she suddenly shrieked out in a voice which I shall never forget. Oh, my God, Helen! It was the band, the speckled band! I rushed out, calling loudly for my stepfather, and I met him hastening from his room in his dressing gown. When he reached my sister's side, she was unconscious, and though he poured brandy down her throat and sent for medical aid from the village, all efforts were in vain. For she slowly sank and died without having recovered her consciousness.